listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Bear with us one moment. We are going to dial back into the studio to get a better connection. All righty then. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory. And I'm going to start off here with a song. Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue and the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I can pass this way again, you can rest assured, I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel-eyed death and men fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us. There was little risk involved. Everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place where it's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount. But nothing really matters much. It's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a futile horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I've heard newborn babies wailing like a mourning dove, and old men with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. There's not a whole lot of shelter these days in Baltimore or Nepal, but the latter, well, it's an act of God or nature or something. There's not much you can do but just go out, you know, dig your way out and go on helping people. Baltimore, on the other hand, Baltimore is a man-made disaster. I've heard people saying that the rioting doesn't solve anything, that surely there was a better way to solve the issues. Can't they just talk it out? But honestly, how can you talk things out when the cops are trying to kill you? Just saying. I'm not advocating violence. I'm a total peacenik. But I understand that desperate people take desperate measures. We need to make big changes. When police run rampant over the people, they turn them into a raging and riotous and rebellious rabble. And then they do have a reason to fear. There was no reason to be afraid until they created the situation. And if they were afraid, if they were not afraid, they had no excuse for killing the people. Not even the slimmest of excuses. It was murder. Our cops, our government are very good at that. We, the people, need to fight back in peace. That's hard to do. Some of us may die if we do that. But that's the only way we can really win. We need to fight back in peace. We are all in need of shelter from the storm. We're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we hope you'll join us here each week from 6 to 8 p.m. Remember to visit freedomslips.com to see their great lineup of shows, and they're listener supported, so do what you can. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Larry Pinkney, Phil Ferruccio, Julius Alafong, and Ed Fallon. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Des Moines, Port Orange, Cameroon, Minneapolis, and wherever you are. We continue with our mini-series regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all this is Fetzer and Barrett on the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, and TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternate, Rachel Maddow, Goodman, Jon Stewart. If not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do is to say something in this mini-series here about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett. More from the book by David Armstrong. In 1776, a certain radical journalist who had recently violated convention by attacking slavery in the Philadelphia papers wrote a pamphlet exhorting the American colonies to declare their independence from England. The journalist was Thomas Paine, and his pamphlet was Common Sense. It sold a phenomenal 150,000 copies in sparsely populated colonial America and lit a fire under the timorous American independence movement. After independence was won, Paine set sail for Europe, where his writing helped fuel the French Revolution. Paine's uncompromising journalism was the most dramatically successful use of media to spark social change in American history. Fast forward. The Berkeley Barb was one of the earliest examples of the new underground media of the America of the 1960s. The Barb was in contrast to the mass media. The Barb backed the Black Power movement, insisting that liberation, not just legalistic civil rights, was the proper goal of people of all races. The Barb also strongly opposed the war. Articles were written about, even by, draft resistors and soldiers in the ranks opposed to the fighting, in contrast to the gentle dissent of liberal clerics on the op-ed pages of major daily newspapers. Today, half of the United States gross national product is generated by the production, dissemination, and consumption of information in its various forms: the press, books, movies, records, and tapes, governments and corporate documents, legal briefs, computer printouts, radio, video discs and tapes, broadcast and cable television. Together, they comprise the consciousness industry. The consciousness industry does more than entertain and inform. It furnishes many of our values and ideas and helps shape our behavior. Of all the institutions of everyday life, the media specialize in orchestrating everyday consciousness. It's not surprising, therefore, that a consciousness itself has become a battleground. Revolutionaries and guardians of the status quo alike understand the importance of controlling the means of producing consciousness. This is from A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week. And also a side note, to hear a very good discussion of the Jade Helm military exercises between Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, check out today's False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio. And this just in, Wolf Blitzer and Amy Goodman and Oprah and Rachel Maddow and Jon Stewart and the Abilene Weekly Advertiser are reporting now that the top two leaders of the world's biggest terrorist organization have been hit by drone airstrikes. Wait. Just wait, please. More is coming in just now. We have eyewitness reports of the two being pulled feet first from the rubble by a joyous mob and now being dragged down Pennsylvania Avenue. And now, kittens, sports, and your local weather reports on the 8s.
And now, it's time for the New American Dream Government Operation Naming Team to swing into action. We are asking our listeners to tell us what the hell Jade Helm means. Here are some of the answers we've received thus far. Just about done evolving. Heck, Ethel, let's move. Had enough leftover meatloaf. Had enough liberal malarkey. Head east, leaders mashugana. For all those trying to figure out Jade Helm, well, anyway, here at least there's some more M words. Mazel Tov, Madonna, Mariachi, Mammoth, Malady, Manhunt, Manacled, Megatron, Maniacal, Minivan, Marauder, Mobster, Misogyny, and Mutiny. Listen to the end of the show closing notes for contact and entry information. And now a word from a funny thing happened on the way to the moon, a brand new Washington, D.C. think tank staffed by American fourth grade students who have questions about the things they were told about America in the third grade. Let's get this straight. We went to the moon 100 years ago, but we never went back. You mean to tell us? The types of adults that we all know never went back to put up Moon National Bank with the electric sign that says the moon time and temperature, and we support our darn moon troops. They did not want to incorporate moon mining company or moon logging. The really stupid adults we know have not organized moon hunting trips to kill a moon moose, moon elk, moon bear, or moon wildebeest. They have not put moon bunny rabbit heads on their walls. There are no fences in the sky to keep moon men from coming here. Nobody listening to everything the moon people are saying to each other. There are no chemtrails above the moon or Agent Orange devastation. No depleted uranium, no dead moon whales and seas or moon cow slaughterhouses. We did not want to make any moon prisons or moon land or moon world. No moon-assisted living, moon condos, moony golf. There's no moon Rushmore or moon mall. And here's the real kicker. The adults that we know did not want to put up a giant United States military base. Well, we American fourth graders have come to a conclusion about the things we were taught as fact in the third grade. Our conclusions are thus. The very fact that there is no Camp Moon means we never ever went there, and they all lied. Our opinion, what? A bunch of crap. Our suggestions based on our research, do not trust anyone over the age of 9. And now, for another episode of Waterboarding, Barbara Bush, sponsored by Mr. Bubble. If we are going to torture people that we say we think are terrorists, but we know are not really terrorists because we did 9/11, there are no terrorists, no Al-Qaeda, no reason for war, and really no information we can gain other than to perpetuate the lie, go deeper into the story of the lie, build and embellish the lie fable, then why not also waterboard people who we know are terrorists, who were in fact our terrorists, who helped us to lie a long time ago and overturn our own country? And this terrorist really knows the truth, and what she knows is actually real. One or two, maybe three quick sessions in the Midland Park Mall in Midland, Texas, which are really not such a big deal anyway, right? Changed the course of the whole country. Just one little goon afternoon, live on national TV during the seventh inning of a Rangers game, could be a beautiful American experience. Something for Ken Burns, the committee to waterboard Barbara Bush, who sat there while her husband worked to murder JFK, while her husband and son worked on the 9/11 project, while her husband invaded Panama and Iraq and thousands, millions died, and she just sat there. She knows more American history than any of us will ever know. We're the committee to waterboard Barbara Bush. It's not really that bad anyway. Endorsed by Alan Dulles, Dick Cheney, George Bush Jr., George Bush Sr., John Yoo, Barack Obama, 2 dental assistants, 4 Walmart produce managers, and millions of folks like you. Sponsored by Mr. Bubble. Get you so clean your mother won't know you. And this just in, Mr. Bubble will now also be sponsoring the committee to waterboard Chris Hedges, John Stewart, Amy Goodman, Rachel Maddow, Matthew Rothschild, Stephen Colbert, Ruth Conniff, Eric Alderman, Bill Moyers, Arianna Huffington, Bill Mayer, Gary Trudeau, Michael Moore, Al Franken, Marcus Zuniga, Noam Chomsky, and Garrison Keillor. Mr. Bubble wants to know why the liberal so-called radical writers do not ever mention the obvious scams of 9/11, Boston, and Sandy Hook. And while they think they are radical fighters and fighting the good fight, they're either bought and paid for, or they're consciously skirting around the edges of the real issues, like frightened water bugs around a swamp. And maybe they should just give up and get construction jobs. Mr. Bubble sees that. Mr. Bubble is confused. Mr. Bubble wants answers. Mr. Bubble wants the truth.
Our first guest of the evening is Ed Fallon. Ed Fallon is, he speaks to us from Des Moines. He's a former Iowa State legislator, candidate for governor, radio host, the Fallon Forum. He recently completed a 3,000-mile walk across America to draw attention to climate change, and even more recently completed a 400-mile walk across Iowa to stop the proposed Bakken oil pipeline. And Chuck will be getting Ed on the phone right about now.
Hello.
Hello, Ed.
Hello, Ed.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
Ed, this is Mike and Chuck, and you're on the New American Dream. How's it going?
Good. Are we
We're on the air right now.
Okay, great.
Okay.
How are you?
Good, good. How's your feet?
My feet are fine. they got a good workout, and they're happy for it. They were happy for a few days, but they're smiling again.
When did you finish the last walk?
I finished on Earth Day. I figured that was a great day to finish a walk across Iowa to try to stop a pipeline from being built. We had an Earth Day rally to stop the pipeline at the state capitol and had a good turnout and some momentum coming out of that. And there has been an effort now to get the legislature to pass a bill that would stop a pipeline from being built in the future. It's hard to describe in detail. It's got a lot of angles to it, but we're hoping that it passes. We got another 2 or 3 weeks before the session ends, and made it out of subcommittee, and we're hoping that it gets through the committee process here in the next week or so.
Ed, you not only did the 400-mile walk across Iowa, you also walked across America. Could you tell listeners who don't know about that walk something? Could you kind of capsulize it?
Yeah, that was a great March for Climate Action. That was last year. We left Los Angeles on March 1st, and we walked over 3,000 miles to Washington, D.C. The goal was to raise awareness about the climate problem and to get people to take action. There were between 35 and 50 of us. There were about 1,500 people at the kickoff event in Los Angeles. And we literally met tens of thousands of people along the way. Lots of good press coverage in the small towns we went through. I felt pretty good about it. I felt like we really made a difference in terms of having a conversation going with people that, normally weren't thinking that much about the issue. So, that walk was focused on, just generally speaking on climate change, raising awareness. The walk I just got done with, it was a totally different animal. That was focused on stopping a really bad idea from happening. That was a 400-mile walk from the southeast corner of Iowa up to the northwest corner to meet with people who are in the path of this pipeline. A lot of them, they may not really, the climate issue may not be what motivates them. They're concerned about property rights. And that's something that I did a lot of work on as a lawmaker. I don't think government should come in and take somebody's private property and turn it over to a developer, or in this case, a pipeline company, to get rich. And, most people agree with that. And that's what we're trying to continue to do now, is find ways of organizing the people who are opposed to it to be able to take effective actions.
How long did it take you to get ready for that walk across America? I'm sure it took a long time.
Well, first of all, getting ready in one way was physically. I've been a bicycler, so I'm in pretty good shape, but I also learned that the biking muscles are not always the same as your walking ones. So I started training I started training in July of 2013, and we started walking in March 2014. So that helped. I mean, nothing can prepare you for it entirely. It's quite a harsh thing you're doing to your body to walk 15 to 20 miles a day for, 8 months. And then you're sleeping in a tent. So, part of it is you just understand that the amount of determination needed, because the issue is so important, you just do it. But the other part of preparing for it, of course, was pulling together all the logistics, getting the word out, recruiting people to march, hiring good staff to help make sure we had, communications covered and people out organizing campsites and figuring out the best routes and organizing events. So there's all that prep as well. And so for me, the challenge was juggling that and the walking. Because I always believe that if you're going to challenge people to do something different or difficult, you have to be willing to do it yourself. I always get frustrated with people who say, hey, here's something we should do. And then they sit back and let other people do the hard work. So I decided that if I was going to challenge people to walk across the country, I had to be prepared to try to do it myself. And it's really quite amazing to me that I could. I think it was really almost a mind over matter thing, because I've had real serious back problems. And I thought maybe that might, play into it. But it worked out. I mean, I was in a lot of pain at times. I was pretty sore and exhausted, but I was able to do it. And there were five people who made every step of the way, and about 20 who were with us, either all the way and marched most of the way. But it was a pretty impressive core of people that made it happen.
Five people. Were you disappointed at all that there was only five?
No, I think the fact that there were five people who made it every step of the way is pretty amazing. People walk across the country once in a while, not often. It's maybe they estimate there's about 10 people a year who do it. And we were half of them last year. And the thing about when you're walking across the country on a schedule, when you're supposed to be in Albuquerque in a certain day, in Colorado on June, in Denver on June 11th, and Des Moines on August 11th, when you're supposed to be in certain places at a certain time, and you've got events scheduled, you can't stop if you get sick. You can't stop if you get injured. You got to keep going. And so the fact that five people made it, and one of them, by the way, is a woman who was 71 years old, which is astounding. That shows real determination, real commitment, and it's an additional challenge that people who are walking, but to take time off, we couldn't do that. We had to keep going. So the other thing I'd say about that too is, I was involved with the Great Peace March back in 1986. My back was a mess. I couldn't walk, but I was organizing. And that was a core of about 300 people. It was as big as 1,200 people at certain times. Out of that 300 people, though, one guy made it every step of the way. So out of 300, one guy, and out of 35 people, five people, that's pretty good. So I'm pretty pleased that many people were able to do it. And I'm pleased that there was a core that was willing to do the hard work day after day, whether the hard work was walking or cooking meals or setting up camp or dealing with some of the other logistical challenges we faced.
In my mind, one of the hard things to deal with would be a kind of a panic might set in if you ever thought that after all this training or all this preparation, you might not make it. Did you ever have a crisis like that?
Oh yeah. When I got to, in the middle of Nebraska, I started getting plantar fasciitis. The bottom of my feet were really sore. And, I was walking into North Olmsted, Ohio. It's a suburb of Cleveland. And it wasn't even that, it was a 15, 16 mile day. It wasn't terribly long. It was long enough. And my feet they went from being sore to being so painful I could hardly walk. And we slept in a church that night. And I remember not even being able to get up. I had to get up to get, I had to get my phone or something in the middle of the night. And I just crawled across the room. And when I got up in the morning, I could hardly stand on my feet. And I, But I was grimly determined. By that time, I was in Cleveland. I was only 400 miles from D.C. You know, it was pretty close, comparatively. And so I started trying to figure out how I could walk with crutches. Because we had a young guy who fractured a toe in Arizona. And he was determined to keep walking. And he got himself a pair of crutches. And he went the rest of the way on crutches. He went all the way from Arizona to D.C. on crutches. So I figured I would try to see how, if I could make that work. And I played around with it. I did a little walking with it, and I decided it wasn't going to work. So I figured out, I decided I'm just going to walk really, really slow and see what happens. Maybe I'll get through half the distance today. And since the next day was a day off, maybe I could get the other half in that day. And it was a 21-mile day, so it was a pretty long day. And I ended up doing the whole day. I arrived late at night. I apparently walked through the most dangerous neighborhood in Cleveland after dark. And I had to stop every hour. I took really small steps. I used my walking stick, so I put a lot of my pressure on my arms. And I would stop every hour, and I would sit down, and I would massage my feet. And that seemed to help. Between that and going slower and taking shorter steps and trying to walk on the grass and on the soft surfaces as much as possible. And then the next day I had a day off, and that really helped me. And then after that, I just kind of kept it slower. You know, I took longer, but I made it work. So, you know, I think the message there is that when people understand the gravity of a crisis, whatever that crisis might be, and I think the climate crisis is the most serious crisis we've ever faced, when people understand the gravity of that, I think we can challenge ourselves to go the extra mile, to do what we need to do to address that crisis. And I think, to me, the march was emblematic of what we all need to do, what we need to do as a society to begin to really address the climate crisis. We've got to make sacrifices as individuals, as a nation. And even if we don't want to, we're going to have to. The situation is going to demand that we have to make sacrifices.
Hey, Ed, pretty soon the music is going to play and we're going to be cut off work. Can you tell people about the Fallon Forum and where they can tune in or what time that you're on?
Sure. Yeah, it's a talk show. It's broadcast live in Des Moines, Iowa, every Monday at 11. And people can hear it online at www.fallonforum.com.
That's it. Thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for all you do.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. Thanks, Mike.
Good night. This is Andy Rooney reporting for the New American Dream Radio Show. Do you ever wonder? Well, the kind of people we have running our government, if we really knew the truth, I believe we would be astonished. Forget about George Washington, the cherry tree, Ronald Reagan making America strong again, the George Bushes riding into the baseball game on national TV to throw out the first ball, then sitting in the front row. Forget about Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, the new liberal Democrats who care about you, SpongeBob, The Simpsons, and South Park, Calvin and Hobbes, Snoopy have more to tell us than those guys. At least in the Soviet Union, when they saw nonsense and lies printed in Pravda and TASS, at least they knew they were lies. We are still at the infancy stage in our development of not questioning the lies. And so the next time there is a bombing or a threat of a bombing or a bunch of blue backpacks found in Bemidji, the healthy American, the true American, the real American thinks CIA, FBI, the police. The real patriot refuses to stand for the national anthem. And rather than another knee-jerk reciting of the Pledge of Allegiance, he says, not until I get some questions answered, because this is important stuff. This has been Andy Rooney reporting for the new nightly news. Seriously, people, don't you ever wonder? We have again received word from Randall from Stevens Point. I got my gun in my truck, he says. He continues, I told you I'm heading for the woods, then up the mountain, and that's where I am right now. I can see y'all right here through my scope. Don't worry, I got the safety on. Okay, it's on now. Tell Bubba Jean I always loved her. Don't follow me. I got on my camo jeans. You'd never find me. When you hear about the big shootout and all that, that'll be me. Randall from Stevens Point is now underground in America. And before he gets started with his message, he wanted us to again relay this message. First, I got something to say to my relatives in Baraboo. I'm really not talking to any of you because you know why. Randall's note continues.
The almost daily murders of young black men and women by police in the United States, a crisis undiminished by the protests of groups such as Black Lives Matter and by the empty rhetoric of black political elites, have given birth to a new young black militant. This militant, rising off the bloody streets of cities such as Ferguson, Missouri, understands that the beast is not simply white supremacy, chronic poverty, and the many faces of racism, but the destructive energy of corporate capitalism. This militant has given up on electoral politics, the courts, and legislative reform, loathes the corporate press, and rejects established black leaders such as Barack Obama, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Michael Eric Dyson. This militant believes it is only in the streets and in acts of civil disobedience that change is possible. And given the refusal of the corporate state to address the mounting suffering of the poor and working poor, draconian state repression, and indiscriminate use of lethal state violence against unarmed people of color, I think the new black radical is right. It will be a long, hot, and violent summer. The world's hundreds of millions of disenfranchised youths. In America, this group's dominated by the black and brown underclass. They come out of the surplus labor created by our system of corporate neo-feudalism. These young men and women have been discarded as human refuse and are preyed upon by a legal system that criminalizes poverty. In the United States, they constitute the bulk of the 2.3 million human beings locked in jails and prisons. The discontent in Ferguson, Athens, Cairo, Madrid, and Ayotzinapa is one discontent. And the emerging revolt, although it comes in many colors, speaks many languages and has many belief systems, is united around a common enemy. Bonds of solidarity and consciousness are swiftly uniting the wretched of the earth against our corporate masters. Corporate power, which knows what is coming, has put in place sophisticated systems of control that include militarized police, elaborate propaganda campaigns that seek to make us fearful and therefore passive, wholesale surveillance of every citizen, and a court system that has stripped legal protection from the poor and any who dissent. The masses are to be kept in bondage, but the masses, especially the young, understand the game. There's a word for what is bubbling up from below: revolution. It can't begin soon enough. The global leadership for this revolt comes not from the institutions of privilege, elite universities where ambitious and self-centered young men and women jockey to become part of the ruling 1%, but from the squalid internal colonies that house the poor and usually people of color. The next great revolutionary in America won't look like Thomas Jefferson. He or she will look like Lupe Fiasco. T-Dub-O is a hip-hop artist from St. Louis. He's one of the founders, along with Tef Poe, Tori Russell, Tara Thompson, and Rika Tyler, of Hands Up United. The organization was formed in the wake of the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson. It has built close alliances with radical organizations in Brazil and elsewhere in Latin America, in Europe, and in Palestine. I honestly think it's going to be worse than last year this summer, T-Dub-O said when I met with him and Tyler at Princeton University, where they'd gone to speak to students. People have become more radical, he said. They've realized the power they have. They're no longer afraid of the police, the state. But also you have a police and military force that's been training for a year to deal with this type of circumstance. So I honestly think this summer is going to be worse. More violence from the police. And this time, you won't have a group of people who's just going to sit there and let it happen to them. You're going to have people that are actually going to fight back. instead of just continue to be peaceful protesters. Right now, everybody is just on edge. I mean, it's the same situation we was in before Mike Brown. People that don't have jobs. There's crime everywhere. There's drugs everywhere. There's predator policing. It's the same circumstances. It's just no cameras. In my city every day, police is pulling somebody over, harassing them, extorting them, he said. Because that's what it is. It's legal extortion. When a government is making 30 to 40% of their yearly budget off tickets, fines, and imprisonment, it's extortion. It's the same thing the mob did in the 20s. So we fight. We can't go back to normal lives. We get followed, harassed, death threats, phones tapped, social media watched. They hack into our emails, hack into our social media account. We all got FBI files. They know we here right now. So, I mean, it's not a game. But it's either continue to deal with not being able to just live like a regular person and dream and have an opportunity, or get up and do something about it. And we decided to do something. Tyler said she was propelled into the movement by seeing the body of Michael Brown, which the Ferguson police left lying in the street for more than 4 hours. I went to Canfield, it's the drive where Brown was killed. I saw the body, I saw the blood, I just broke down. And ever since then, I've just been out there as an activist every day. They left Brown in the street for 4.5 hours in the hot sun on concrete just for display, she said. That reminded me of a modern-day lynching. Because, you know, they used to lynch slaves and then have it displayed. And that's basically showing us that the system is not built for us. It made me wake up a little bit more. No person should have to go through this, T-Dubbo said. Whether it's in America, Palestine, Mexico, Brazil, Canada, nobody should have to go through this. You look at a bunch of young people in Ferguson, their age ranges anywhere from 12 to 28 or 29, that went against the most powerful military force in this world. That's pretty much what happened. It's not what's explained, but that's what it was. It was tanks on every corner, phones tapped, they follow us. Every day we was out there, we thought we were going to die. At one point in time, they said they were going to kill us. We're not shooting rubber bullets tonight. We're shooting live ammunition. And these are the things that you don't see on the news. It was just because we was tired of being treated as less than people. Just for opportunity to be able to walk the streets and live and breathe and do what everybody else does. And that's pretty much what we was fighting for. I mean, the level of oppression, it's kind of hard to fathom and believe that it's actually true in America, especially in the middle of America. But it's real. Where you have people that are judged off the neighborhoods they come from and the color of their skin, and they're denied certain opportunities. T-Dubbo, after the murder of Brown and the unrest in Ferguson, was invited with other community leaders to meet with President Barack Obama in the White House. The president, he said, spoke in cliches about black-on-black crime, the necessity of staying in school, working hard, and the importance of voting. He asked me, did I vote for him? I told him no. I didn't vote for him either time because I didn't want to vote for him just because he was black. I felt like that would have been shallow on my end because he's never honestly spoken and touched and said he was going to do anything for my community or the issues that we face on a daily basis. So why would I vote for somebody like that? Well, you white, black, male, female, so on and so forth. As president, he's proof that the system works, Obama told T-Dubbo. The hip-hop artist said, this statement shows how out of touch Obama is with the reality faced by poor people of color. I think D.C. is a perfect example of what America is, he says. You have this big White House representing a government that was built by slaves, that's beautiful, excellent manicured lawns, and right outside the gate, you have 50 homeless people sleeping in a park right outside the gate of the White House. That perfectly describes America. as far as politics, T-Dubbo said, it's going to go either one of two ways. Right now, we have a window that's closing pretty fast to where we can either recreate this system for something that's going to actually be equal for all people, or they're going to recreate the system to where we'll never be able to punch it in the mouth like we did in Ferguson again. So, I mean, we don't know what that's going to look like. We know we're dedicated. We're going to continue to fight. It's going to take full-fledged revolution to make a change. The worst of the worst would be civil war. That's just where my mind is. I don't see them pulling back, he said, of the state and its security forces. They have no problem killing people. They have no problem shooting gas at babies, pregnant people, old people. They don't have an issue with it. And our politicians are just standing around with their arms folded. As long as the powers that be are in control, the oppression isn't going to go anywhere, he said. It's really going to take people to unite worldwide, not just in America, not just in St. Louis, not just in one particular city or state. It's going to have to be people identifying their struggles with each other worldwide, internationally, and say, enough is enough. That's the only way oppression will ever leave.
Our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney. Larry Pinkney is a regular guest on our show in the third week of the month, but we asked him to come back today to talk about Baltimore, and he has agreed to do that. Larry Pinkney speaks to us from Minneapolis. He's an author, radio host. He recently wrote the foreword for Sidney Sheehan's new book. He's a former Black Panther, former political prisoner. And Chuck will get Larry on the line right about now.
Hello, Larry Pinkney speaking.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
All right. Greetings to you, Chuck and Mike, and greetings to the entire audience that listens to New American Dream. Delighted to be on the program. Not happy about the news, of course. I'm sure that none of us are with what has been going on and will probably continue to go on in this country. But there is a silver lining, as they say, to the dark cloud. And, of course, I know that everyone knows that I'm talking about the outrageous militarized police brutality with respect to New York, specifically Eric Garner, who screamed at least 11 times that he said, "I can't breathe." And then, of course, we have Freddie Gray in Baltimore, whose spine, 80% of it was severed and his throat was crushed. But this is not unusual, I'm sad to say. What is unusual and what is positive, however, is that people around the nation, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people, just everyday, ordinary, struggling people, are waking up and saying no. And I want to remind everyone, all of my sisters and brothers out there in the New American Dream radio land, I want to remind all of you to not get sucked in. Please, do not get sucked in by the corporate stream, vomit stream narrative of events. It's not merely about color. In fact, most importantly, what this struggle is about is economics. It's about the fact that people are being disenfranchised and are feeling despair. But I would say do not despair, because people are awakening. It never happens fast enough, but it is happening. I want to remind everyone of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when he said that, quote, I'm paraphrasing, that violence is the voice of the unheard. And in this case, he was talking about disenfranchised people across this nation and, quite frankly, throughout the world. Unfortunately, the violence that we are truly facing, we are facing all of us together, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. And we must learn quickly that this struggle is a collective struggle. We are all in this together. That's the silver lining, if you will, to that dark cloud. So we must address, as an entire people, all of us of all colors, we must address the root causes of these rebellions. They're not riots. They're rebellions. Let's be very clear about that. CNN, ABC, CBS, Fox News, PBS, all of them want to push this narrative that these are riots. But they're not riots. They're rebellions. And the corporate stream, vomit stream news media, so-called news media, knows that. More importantly, we the people, everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people must know that. So the time is here. We're all a part of this struggle. We all have something to do, to something to contribute to this struggle. And it's not just about Ferguson or Baltimore or New York or Washington, D.C. or wherever else the next rebellion will occur. What it is really about is all of us understanding that the policies, and I repeat, the policies of the Democrats and Republicans who want to keep us all on the plantation, keep us divided and in fear of each other, those policies must be utterly and totally rejected. You know, the draconian policies of drone man, war criminal, kill list Barack Obama are absolutely disgusting. And it's not just Obama. It's his Democrat and Republican minions and the corporations who control the narrative on the news media, or I should say of the so-called news media, what I call the vomit stream media. But brothers and sisters, sisters and brothers, we must control our narrative. We know what is happening. We know, and that's wherein the power lies. So I just want to, I know people are feeling a little bit upset, maybe a little bit down, a little bit nervous. Well, look, let me say to you the words of the late, great Bobby Sands, the freedom fighter, the Irish freedom fighter. Bobby Sands said that when he talked about the struggle, you know, he pointed out that our revenge will be the laughter on the faces of our children. That's going to be, okay, so we have a lot to do and a long ways to go, but let's keep on staying busy. And for those who haven't gotten busy, get busy. And I just want to remind all of us, care what your color is, what your gender is, that we're going to win this struggle. But struggles are not easy. They're long and they're protracted. And we are in the belly of the beast, euphemistically speaking. We, the people, are in the belly of the beast in the United States. But that also is a double-edged sword, because that means that we have the opportunity and the responsibility to not only ourselves and the people in this nation, but to Mother Earth globally, to the peoples throughout Mother Earth, to take a stand for justice, to take a stand for justice. That's what this struggle is about. These are not riots. These are rebellions. And are there provocateurs and agents, etc.? Of course. That's what this government and other governments do. You can count on it. But what we have is each other. And there's way more of us than of them. So I want to say to everybody, all my sisters and brothers, be strong. Gird your hips, as they say. Be strong. Stand up. Don't be down. You know, stand up. This struggle is a long struggle, but we're making strides at great cost. We are making strides. But let us understand we must do this together. And I want to hearken back to the days of the original Black Panther Party. Do not be confused. I'm not talking about the so-called new Black Panther Party. I want to harken back to the days of the original Black Panther Party when we said, all power to the people, black, white, brown, red, yellow, all power to the people. So be strong, be united, work hard. It's not easy. Be truthful and honest with one another. It takes work. This is a long struggle. And as the great freedom fighter from Guinea-Bissau, Africa said, you know, tell no lies. The struggle is a long one. It's a hard one. Be truthful to the people. Be truthful to ourselves. Because you know what, sisters and brothers? We're going to win this struggle. But it's going to be and continue. It will continue to be a struggle that really requires all that we can give. So let me just take that old U.S. Marine saying. They said, be all that you can be. Sure, be all that you can be. Not a Marine. Be all that you can be. Be a people's revolutionary. Be about the people. Everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. So hope I haven't gone over my time, but I really want people I want their hearts, our hearts, to be strong. I want us to remember that we are going to succeed, and there will be sacrifices. But understand, that's what struggle is about. And as Bobby Sands said, our revenge will be the laughter of our children.
Well, Larry, thank you very much. You did not go over time. Anytime now, I expect to hear the music coming in to cut us off. But I want to thank you for your inspiring words. And I really like that saying about our revenge will be the laughter of our children.
Indeed, my brother, indeed. And I want to thank you and all the listeners. You know, thank you so much. We're going to keep on keeping on. We're going to carry this struggle on. And ultimately, we're going to win.
All right. Thanks again. And we'll talk to you in about 3 weeks.
Thank you, my brother.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others. Here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, working stiffs. What happened to my world? You know, a friend of mine sent me a 6-minute YouTube about Brooklyn, New York, circa 1950s and 60s. It would take this writer far too much time citing anecdotal evidence to show how great it was then as compared to now. Imagine city beaches on hot and steamy days when the water was not polluted with runoff waste and garbage. We had the milkman delivering glass containers of fresh cream on the top milk to our doorstep. There were a myriad of mom-and-pop retail shops in every neighborhood throughout our diversified borough. The mall was still a thing of the future. Thank goodness for that. There were supermarkets, yes, indeed, but most of our moms, yeah, lots of families only needed one breadwinner in those days, would still frequent the local butcher, bakery, produce store, etc. I can recall when, during my younger years in the 1950s, we had an old Italian family around the corner that actually grew all kinds of vegetables, lettuce, and sold them at real low prices. Many families, especially the Italian and Jewish ones, loved to order old-fashioned seltzer from who else? The Seltzer Man. He would come by our block each week to pick up the empties and refill our orders. Imagine. The local candy store, some called them luncheonettes, were the meeting place for the neighborhood men to argue sports, the ladies to share gossip, and we kids to hang out after school, drinking egg creams and lime Ricky sodas. They stayed open late each night so as to receive delivery of the next day's Daily News or Mirror, which contained the daily number, which was derived from the local handle at the local thoroughbred racetrack. My street or block, as we refer to it, had around 100 families living in two-family homes. Usually one occupant was the owner or landlord, and in the other apartment was a tenant. Now, in those days, there were not as so many absentee landlords as there are now. We had a few in each neighborhood, but that was the exception, not the rule. Most families saved up for a house and used the rent from the tenant to help with the mortgage. Obtained, by the way, at a local neighborhood bank where the mortgage paper stayed, not sold and bundled as investment instruments like today. Our block was like a small village. Everyone knew each other for the most part and would interact accordingly. Yes, we had the usual feuds and arguments over who did what to whose front yard or parked car, etc. Yet most of the neighbors would sit outside on their stoops in the evenings and kibitz. We boys didn't need to go to the park to play. We had the street and sidewalk and backyards to conduct our punch ball, touch football, stoop ball, slap ball, box ball, Chinese handball, ring-a-levio games, etc. As long as the weather was okay and there was still daylight, we stayed out there until our parents yelled for us to get in and finish your homework. Nowadays, the newest joke is the father telling his son, you know, you've been acting up, so I'm going to punish you by making you go outside to play. The era of the electronic gadget was non-existent in those days, and thank goodness for that. We were, to coin the phrase, streetwise. Yet, we had the bums of Brooklyn to root for, of course, until 1958 when they moved to L.A. Despite losing our beloved Dodgers, we still had Coney Island with the beaches, all those rides, and, of course, the great Nathan's Famous. We had Sheepshead Bay with the great seafood restaurants and fishing boats. We had Fulton Street in downtown Brooklyn with fabulous shopping anchored by the celebrated Abraham and Strauss department store. Our subway system was perhaps the best in the country, used by many of our dads each day to travel to work and leave the family car at home. Brooklyn College was one of the largest and finest educational institutions in perhaps the whole country, and it offered free tuition. In those days, you needed at least an 88 high school average and a high SAT score to be admitted. Can you imagine that? Well, the world of the baby boomers is gone forever. Our kids and our grandkids will never understand how great things were then, despite all the flaws. Yes, there was still unofficial segregation throughout Brooklyn in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and a great deal of racism and prejudice. Many times this writer would hear the expression, Jewed me down. Many of my friends, the ones who went to Catholic school, actually felt that it was the Jews that killed Jesus. Of course, never being taught enough times that he, too, was Jewish. Because our neighborhood had perhaps no black or Latino families living with us, many people only saw what the media portrayed these people to be, poor and criminally minded. Since we had many Jewish families living in our area, anti-Semitism usually was done in whispers and in a more controlled manner. I can remember as a boy of six when my mother took me to Coney Island on the trolley. Can you imagine that, the trolley? On a hot summer day, she would bring me to Steeplechase Amusement Park, and guess what? They did not allow blacks in, since it was a private club, as they referred to it. Unreal. Well, enough of reminiscing. Sad how this 21st century America is a land of box stores, fast food franchises and chains, and, of course, Walmart, the king of all the beasts. Good night.
I'd just like to mention that Lorraine and I do 60% of our shopping at a little store, a little neighborhood grocery store, and we love it because it's personal, and you don't have to be stuck with the big box stores, the Walmarts, the big supermarkets. Just thought I'd throw that in. Back to you, Mike.
Well, Chuck, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. Operation Jade Helm begins across the United States, and in other news, on April 22nd, Wolfgang Halbig traveled to Connecticut to meet with his attorney, Kay Wilson, and confront Newtown and Connecticut officials, withholding information pertinent to Halbig's numerous public records requests. This hearing, which was to have taken place on March 34th, was abruptly postponed. Word has it that Governor Malloy also confronted Halbig during his visit and adamantly denied any foreknowledge of the Sandy Hook massacre event. For more on this and other news, go to memoryholeblog.com.
A U.S. Border Patrol agent who killed a teenager when he fired across the border from Texas into Mexico cannot be sued in U.S. courts by the Mexican teen's family, a federal appeals court ruled Friday. The unanimous ruling was issued by the full Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, reversing most of an earlier 2-1 ruling by a 3-judge panel of the court. The border agent's lawyer said the opinion vindicated his client. an attorney for the teen's family, said they haven't decided whether to appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. We leave for others to decide whether this court has lost its moral bearings, attorney Marion Riley said in a written statement. On behalf of the parents of an innocent slain teenager, a human being, regardless of his nationality, we simply note that they and we had not expected such a decision from a court of the United States. U.S. Border Patrol agent Jesus Mesa Jr. shot 15-year-old Sergio Adrian Hernandez Gareca in June 2010. U.S. investigators said Mesa was trying to arrest immigrants who had illegally crossed into the country when he was attacked by people throwing rocks. Mesa fired his weapon across the Rio Grande, twice hitting Hernandez Gareca. The shooting occurred near a bridge between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua.
Blackfeet tribal leaders have joined with environmental groups, other American Indian tribes, and the band Pearl Jam to campaign for the cancellation of oil and gas leases near Glacier National Park. Tribal leaders on Wednesday said they plan to erect billboards to raise awareness and encourage the Interior Department to cancel the 18 leases in the Badger 2 Medicine area. Tribal Historic Preservation Officer John Murray says the leases are in the vicinity of sites continuously occupied by Blackfeet for thousands of years. The area is the home of the creation story of the four Blackfoot tribes. Pearl Jam posted a message on Twitter urging its fans to support the tribe's effort, which has backing from U.S. Senator John Tester. The leases were suspended in the 1990s. One leaseholder has a pending lawsuit to lift the suspension. But that's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Julius Alafong. Julius comes to us from Cameroon. Julius is a writer and an activist, and he also always has a unique perspective of the world from a place that, we can only get to this way. And we look forward to hearing from Julius.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Mike, for having me once more on the show. This time around, I will be talking about the recent elections that took place in the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Of course, Boko Haram will not be left out. The Federal Republic of Nigeria is made up of 36 states, distributed in majority religiously between Muslims found in the north and Christians found in the south. The current population of Nigeria is made up of about 177 million inhabitants, which makes it the most populated African state and at the same time the economic powerhouse of Africa. Since its independence from Britain in 1960, Joseph Ebeg-Bulen of the Political Science Department of the University of Calabar in Nigeria, in an article published in June 2012, holds that the Nigerian society has never been well governed because, as he puts it, good, strong leaders have never been in charge. The Nigerian state got its first democratic experiment in 1960, followed by a military regime and then back to democratic regime in 1999. It should be noted that from 1960 to now, Nigeria has had about 13 leaders, if I'm not mistaken, with two former military leaders ruling for the second time under the banner of Democrat. All these leaders, from the first democratic leader in 1960 till the second democratic leader in 1999 till the leader in 2007, Musa Yar'Adua, and of course, President Goodluck Jonathan, who just threw in the sponge for President Buhari. All these leaders have been qualified as selfish and corrupt leaders, whose Anja reigns have been qualified as reigns that have blighted the lives of Nigerians. They have been qualified as tribal, mediocre, opportunist, and money-minded people. For example, let's look at General Yakubu Gowon, who ruled Nigeria from 1966 to 1975. Joseph Ebegbolen qualifies him as the only head of state in the world who had so much money that he did not know what to do with it. This means that he was a neo-patrimonialist who confused what belonged to the state to his private property. Then came General Olusegun Obasanjo, who ruled from 1976. Although he charted some path for democracy, he was qualified as a leader who had particular hatred for intellectuals. We also have Shegu Shagari, another leader who ruled from 1979 to 1983. His administration was qualified as having wild appetite or very wild appetite for materialism. The current president, who just won his elections against Goodluck Jonathan, first ruled from 1983 to 1985. And during his reign, back then, he impoverished every corrupt politician. He imprisoned every corrupt politician and brought out draconian decrees which were promulgated to check up leadership excessiveness. After General Buhari, back then, we had General Babangida. Babangida is said to have turned the country into a political laboratory, and he came out with a grandiose political transition that were not only the most expensive in Africa, but ended up producing no democracy at all. We equally have General Sani Abacha, who ruled from 1993 to 1998. His iron fist management gave him the leeway to transform the country into his personal estate, where he amassed so much wealth within 5 years that was above the budget of most black African countries. He died in 1998, and this led to the transition for the first democratic elections in 1999, where General Olusegun Obasanjo won, this time coming to power as a Democrat. He relentlessly struggled to combat corruption, but his efforts were fruitless, because all those he placed under him were considered corrupt. He is accused to have sold the government property to himself and his cronies below the cost price. President Jonathan came in as vice president and then president because his boss, President Musa Yar'Adua, fell sick in 2007 after his election. Jonathan finally took over as president in 2010 after the demise of President Yar'Adua and then stood elections in 2011 and won to serve his first legal and first elected mandate as president. But practically, he had served two mandates as vice president and as president after winning the 2011 elections. The problem of Boko Haram came up very strongly in 2011 after Jonathan's elections. Many people interpret the re-emergence of Boko Haram in 2011 as a revolt against Jonathan's election. This is because from 1999, there was this zoning agreement that when a president comes from the Christian South, the next president should come from the Muslim North. But after Olusegun Obasanjo, who ruled from 1999 to 2007, serving his two terms as a Southern Christian, it was time for a Northern Muslim to rule. And that is why President Yar'Adua, who was a Muslim from the North, won the presidential elections in 2007. But immediately he fell sick. His vice president was in charge. But another thing to note is that when the president is from the North, the vice president should be from the South and vice versa. So according to this zoning agreement, President Jonathan shouldn't have stood as candidate in 2011 because it was considered that he was serving a term made for the Muslim Northern regions. So this is considered as one of the reasons why Boko Haram movement re-emerged in 2011 after Jonathan's victory. So with the March 28, 2015 elections, Jonathan had very slim chances to succeed because not only he was unable to clarify the whereabouts of the almost or the above 200 Chibok teenage schoolgirls were kidnapped, but he did nothing serious in fighting Boko Haram, which had claimed more than 4,000 lives in Nigeria, Cameroon, and Chad, and so many displaced refugees. Added to this, Nigeria, like most African countries, is marred with insecurity, socioeconomic and political problems, high-level corruption, abject poverty, hunger, diseases, and destitution. This was reason enough for Buhari to win. Another reason why Buhari had all the chances to win was because, first, he was from the north, and many people of good thinking were aware that the southern Christians were cheating the northerners of their term. Buhari, being a Muslim from the north, and above all a former general, and coupled to the fact that during his first reign as a military leader, he imprisoned every corrupt politician and brought out draconian diseases to check leadership excessiveness, were more reasons for him to win. There are a lot of expectations, however, with Buhari as president to find and recover the kidnapped schoolgirls, to quell Boko Haram, to bring back the million displaced Nigerians who are displaced in and out of Nigeria. After this, he is expected to bring back economic stability, provide shelter, social and infrastructural amenities, quality education, employment, and more. He is also expected to make amends in the administration, where it is held that the amount of money spent on public officers is far too high, and that the running budget highly outweighs investment budget. To end this presentation, Mike and Choke, it is important to note that one of the basic aspects of democracy is for leaders to be changed at the helm of the state. This is because people feel belonging when the choice of their leaders is respected. Another thing is that when President Jonathan made his declaration, when he said, "Nobody's ambition is worth the blood of any Nigerian," all in quote, this is a strong message to other incumbents and other African leaders who by all means want to cling to power. Democracy is not only about change at the helm of the state. We should note that. It is equally responding to the plight of the people. When people cry for social and cultural and political well-being, it should be taken into consideration. People need good schools, good health facilities, good infrastructure, clean environment, freedom to participate, freedom of expression, freedom to criticize and see their criticisms being taken seriously. Nevertheless, Buhari will not be able to solve all Nigeria's problems, but good leadership requires that his own little quota, which he is going to chip in before his mandate ends, should be surrounded with transparency and accountability so that the next leader will take from where he failed and continue. This is how we successfully put in place a great nation. Thank you, Choke. Thank you, Mike, for giving me the opportunity to present what just happened around me in Nigeria some few weeks backward. See you some other time again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was a fascinating summary of the area, Cameroon and Nigeria, and Boko Haram. And we're looking forward to welcoming Awafong Julius Teneng to our regular lineup of columnists, so that instead of just showing up or just having his say on the fifth Thursday when in five Thursday months, he's going to be joining us on the fourth Thursday of every month. The reason we can offer that it's very unfortunate. We have lost our monthly columnist, Steve Cowett, who died early this month. And we will miss him very much, but we are very happy to have Awafong Julius Tenang from Cameroon as a new monthly columnist. Thank you.
B-W-E-R-R-U-N, B-R-U-N, B-W-E-R-R-U-N, B-R-U-N. All we need is a 10 and a 5, or a car and keys and a sober driver. B-W-E-R-R-U-N, B-R-U-N. We now join in progress another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get Green and Gold the recognition they deserve on the state flag, as well as designated summertime vestments for the Wisconsin Catholic Archdiocese of Green Bay. And now we bring you straight out of Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99. Hal is just now refilling the plastic peanut bowl.
Schlitz, Hal.
You got it. Coming right up, Curly.
You know, Hal?
What's that, Curly?
Republican or Democrat, this nation's affluent, urban, and suburban classes understand their bread's butter on the corporate side. Primary difference between the two parties is the Republicans pretty much admit they grasp and even endorse some of the nastiest facts of life in America. Republicans honestly tell the world, listen in on my phone calls, piss test me until I'm blind, kill and eat all of my neighbors right in front of my eyes, but show me the money. Let me escape with every cent I can kick out of the suckers, the taxpayers, anybody else I can get a headlock on, legally or otherwise. Democrats in Congress seem content to catalog the GOP's outrages against the Republic, showing proper indignation while laughing at episodes of The Daily Show. But they stand behind the American brand, imperialism. They support our troops, though you'll be hard put to find any of them who've served alongside them or who would send one of their own kids off to lose an eye or an arm in Iraq. They play the imperial game, maintain their credit ratings, and plan to keep the beach house and the retirement investments if it means sacrificing every damn Lindy England in West Virginia.
You got that right, Curly. Here you go.
Ah, thanks. Middle-class Americans do not feel threatened by the slow encroachment of the police state or the Patriot Act. It's because they live comfortably enough and exercise their liberties very lightly, never testing the boundaries. You never know you're in a prison unless you try the door. What white middle America loathes these days are poor and poorish people, especially the kind who look and sound like they just might live in a house trailer. They will swear on a stack of lands and catalogs that they're not bigots, but, well, human nature being what it is, we're all kicking someone else's dog around, whether we admit it or not. There was and still is a tremendous fear that poor and working class Americans might one day come to understand where their political interests reside. Personally, I think the elites worry too much about that. We dumb working folk were clubbed into submission long ago and now require only proper medication for our high levels of cholesterol, enough alcohol to keep the sludge moving through our arteries, a 24/7 mind-numbing spectacle of titties, tabloid TV, and terrorist dramas. Throw in a couple of new flavors of XXL edible thongs. You've got a nation of drowsing hippos who will never notice that our country's been looted or even that we've become homeless ourselves. Somebody left the American dream in the toaster too long. It's now burnt to a crisp. One more. Then I gotta go, Hal. I just gotta go. Where should I go, Hal?
You got it, Curly. Well, Curly, you can stay here, or you can go.
Well, that's one hell of an option, Hal. That's one hell of an option.
Join us next week for another Wisconsin daytime drama straight out of Kenosha, sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Wissota Mulch Beer. And now the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They really look really, really old. We continue with letters from Father Larry Rosebaugh from El Salvador, 1986. Larry Rosebaugh was a United States priest, a member of the Order of the Oblates of Mary. He was from Appleton, Wisconsin. After teaching high school in Duluth, Minnesota, and Chicago, he came to Milwaukee in 1968 and worked at Milwaukee's Casa Maria Hospitality House, a facility linked with the Catholic Worker Movement, which gives shelter to homeless families and women. He spent years in U.S. federal prisons for anti-war protests. He was a member of the Milwaukee 14, a group of peace activists who in September 1968 broke into Milwaukee draft board offices, removing and burning some of the files in a nearby park while holding a prayer service. Like most members of the Milwaukee 14, Rosebaugh served 20 months in prison for his action. But mainly, Larry Rosebaugh was a missionary, taking seriously the words of Jesus and the spirit of the gospel, spending your life and your energies with the poor of the world. Rosebaugh was murdered May 18, 2009 by masked gunmen in northern Guatemala. At the time of the attack, Rosebaugh was in a van with four other oblates who were headed to a meeting in Playa Grande, Guatemala. Another priest was wounded. While the attack was supposedly a carjacking, the killers escaped without taking the vehicle. But before that day, he did so many things. One of those things was to send back letters telling those of us in the U.S. about his work with the poor. This letter was from El Salvador during the 1980s, the very, very bad years.
In my first letter to you, I took some time explaining how I got to El Salvador and how my past year in Mexico helped prepare the way for the work to be done here. Let me tell you a little now about Benjamin. Benjamin is mature and his faith unfaltering. Years ago, he began to offer his assistance to the parish priest. As handyman, his skills and visions reach out in all directions. He was here the morning I arrived, preparing the altar, adjusting the microphone, and calling the people far and near to participate in the liturgy. We see a sort of mutual commitment to each other. In the mornings, I try to work in the fields with him, and he keeps close by to respond to the needs of the parish, which are many. Benjamin, as other campesinos, is a person with tremendous energy and physical strength. His disciplined life has hewed him into a person of faith and vision, accompanied by an endurance to live within a multitude of obstacles and hardships. So together we work in the fields, visit the villages close by, and little by little share ideas with the people. Our day usually ends with a decade of the rosary together and spontaneous prayers for the community, our families, and friends, both near and distant. The news received each day is a burden, often harder to swallow than to climb up the hillside or the hot sun of the campo. That the war continues is a fact. That the goal of the government and armed forces is to gain a military victory is bitter news. Bitter even more so when it is known that it is the U.S. that influences and controls all decisions made here in El Salvador. To reach this goal of military victory while evading serious efforts to dialogue, the government has backed a new approach by the armed forces to win over the people. It's called United to Rebuild. During the last 2 months, we've watched this program develop among the people of this small city. It's a well-planned program with hopes to carry it out extensively across the country. The government armed forces have had control of our town for over a year. 100 or so soldiers live here and guard the city on all sides. A few weeks ago, a battalion arrived from the conflict area, war zones, of Morazan. About 250 soldiers camped out in the park across from the church with their heavy artillery and all. Unknown to the people, their unpublished goal was to initiate this program of United to Rebuild. It is the 27th of December as I write these words. I write them with joy in my heart. 50 children and youth received First Communion Christmas Day and united with their families, drank hot chocolate, and ate freshly baked sweetbread. Where does this find Benjamin, to whom I dedicate this newsletter? His heart and soul are very close to his people and those suffering most. He understands what is happening. He was indirectly asked not to ring the church bells at 5 in the morning as it wakens the troops sleeping in the plaza. Until the message is delivered in person, I will continue to resume this Christian duty. Hopefully we can get back to the fields on a regular basis. Benjamin's heart is always in the campo and work there is urgent. This is enough for now. Again, many thanks for writing. We are for sure close in spirit. My thoughts and prayers are with you. Larry Rosebaugh.
This has been the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They're really cool because they really look really, really old. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth has big burritos, an apricot wheat beer, and a parade to celebrate cold weather. But Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 in the morning, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We join Penny Jones and Fuff Dublin out to the cabin property where Fluff had placed his Bigfoot recorder the other night, and rather than Bigfoot, he had heard people's voices like someone being hurt or worse. Now they are at the cabin and they are hearing things and seeing things.
Oh, man. That's no monkey sound. Fluff dug a finger into his ear to dig out the spittle. These things were human and able to feel, to think, to give up, to be depressed. Okay, finally, with letting the last ounce of energy and resolve and get up and go seep from their chests like a bald front tire at 6 a.m. on the morning of the first big snowstorm, and your boss says, "One more time and that's it." And the kids in the kitchen window watching you out in the dark alley on your knees in the slush and the rocks. And who's going to watch them all day if you do make it to work anyway? They're just like us, Buff thought. His fingers grappled with the corner of wood and yanked his right leg around his face, even with the edge. His left heel in his untied boot caught, and his gripping fingers ignored the wide white eyes, and slammed the foot down flat and pressed and shoved his chest up past the edge out into the open. "Boy, they've been busy," he whispered. Buff's eyes ran along a rope passing over and around and between a perfectly spaced line of white birch trees. Right in front of him was a deer hanging by its legs, its stomach sliced vertically and its guts gone, showing red, sterile ribs. The rope gently swayed, bounced lightly, and the small antlers jabbed the ground again, again. Like a character in a black-and-white silent movie with wide eyes and his bleached white and pink hands still grasping the corner, Fluff stuck his neck farther out. The rope line in the trees fell away in a straight line. Pup could see another deer between the next two trees and part of another behind that one. To see more, he must come out. His grasping hand gripped and pushed and vaulted Pup away from the house corner and into the grass. He walked in line with the rope and the deer in the trees. He backstepped to gain the angle to see down the line. He saw three more deer, two with antlers digging at the ground, poking, coming up with leaves on their tips. The rope bounced. Pup took a step back and then two football drill sidesteps, starting to crouch and hold his hands out. Penny walked behind. One of the deer farther down was still alive. How could it be alive with all its insides carved out? Pup stared at the bouncing upside-down figure and stepped toward it, crouching lower and lower as he inched closer. Pup knelt on the ground in front of the man hanging upside down by his legs. With his hands, the man pushed up, bouncing the rope and the deer. He looked upside down at Pup, and Pup thought the contortions could be a smile. He wore jeans and boots and a sweater that fell down, revealing his stomach and chest. His long hair was curly. Blood dripped from somewhere and gobbed up the dirt. Full black hair, green eyes open, mouth open, drooping. Good teeth, white. Pup got on his hands and knees and tried to turn his head upside down to see into the man's eyes. The man's fingers clawed into the leaves and the grass and the dirt and dug like two busy drag lines. One hand held a mass of leaves and the other a load of bloody dirt. His body relaxed and fell and the whole line bobbed and bounced. Pup looked to his left and saw a young woman with long black hair that could have made her the dead man's sister. Pup crawled on his knees toward her. Penny walked behind, turning to look back and up and all around. Her brown eyes were open, and her tongue lolled out of her mouth like a cow on the kill floor. She wore a green flannel jacket, tight jeans, and boots with white fur at the top. Her button shirt hung down, revealing a wound in her stomach. Bam, bam! A wood-knocking sound came down from the trees and the hill. An eagle glided out over the open field and away. Boom, bam, boom! Pup started and jerked his head at the sound of car doors slamming and voices, excited voices, hurrying, shuffling through leaves. Somebody's here. A woman's voice sounded like a smoke alarm at 3 a.m., which made the other voices and steps and shuffling even more animated, hurrying towards them. Pup crouched and, seeing he was out in the wide open, stood and ran all out down the rope line, past more deer, more people. Penny ran after him. Penny slammed a shoulder into the last tree and pulled himself around behind it and peered out. Pup peeked out the other side. People and more people flooded into the cabin backyard. Penny looked to the tree line, then back at the growing, excited, fast, frantic crowd. He drew his knife from its sheath and jammed it into the ground. He drew his pistol, a silver revolver, from the holster on his left side. He rolled it, checked it, shoved his shoulder into the tree and steadied the weapon in both hands. Penny couldn't see the whole scene, the rope, the arriving people. He crouched and lunged, landing head over heels in the brush. He crawled on hands and knees up the hill, pulling himself by small trees as it grew steeper. Pup wondered what the F, and followed, somersaulting into the bushes because he'd seen Penny do it. Penny came to a rock cropping. He hid behind it. Pup crawled in behind. Penny looked down at the people. He rested the revolver on the rock with both hands, aiming at the growing crowd. Penny and Pup watched over the top at the group below, running, walking down the rope line, looking up into the trees. They all stopped for a moment to listen and look, then went on with their scurrying around like ants that had just had their home kicked over by a third grader on our way home from school. The leaves were hurried along by a woods wave, a breaker that stopped and went, leaving silence in its wake. Penny cleaned his face with his forearm, wiping a dirt track across his forehead. "We've got to get closer," he said. "What?" said Pop. "No, no, we've got to get out of here, man." He grabbed Penny's arm and pulled. It would not budge. "Come on," said Puff. Penny kept the pistol aimed down the hill, passing the gold ball sight from target to target. "I forgot my knife." Penny looked at Puff. "Shit, leave it, man. They won't find it. We'll come back in the spring. Come on, let's go." He grabbed Penny's arm and stood. He pulled. Puff knelt next to Penny. "So, what is all this, huh? What do you think?" Penny shoved his revolver into the holster. "You heard this stuff on your recorders." "I don't know. I got no idea." Penny got down low to crawl on his knees and then to his stomach. His face plowed through thickets and grass and leaves. His nose touched his knife. He squatted again by the fat tree. Puff pulled up next to him. "I got to get closer," Penny said. "Why? No!" Puff hissed. Puff watched Penny's boots disappear into the brush. Penny moved slowly, placing one knee, then an elbow, now moving his stomach up a bit. Puff sat with his back against the tree, trying not to breathe, trying not to hear the rope squeaking, the groans, or the heavy footsteps of the boots of the probably organizers of a big, big game feast this coming Saturday at the National Guard Armory, 4:30 to 9 p.m. Penny peered around the tree and through the brush. He could make out words and different voices, faces, clothes. The dozen and more people stood with hands on their hips, staring into the woods. They walked up to the edge and peered in as if the woods were an Iowa cornfield and they could go no farther. Penny began to see what he was seeing. There was a big man, typical hunter type, with camouflage clothes, military type black boots, camouflage hat. And another, a woman in blaze orange everything. But the rest were police. Policemen and police women, some with hands on sidearms the way police do on television when entering a suspect building or door. One woman in blue put one knee to the ground and leaned low, one hand on her gun, one palm flat on the ground. She turned her police ball cap around and touched leaves and ground with her nose. She sniffed, trying to smell them, to track them. A shiver ran down Penny's back, and the hair on his arm stood up. "Hey, hey!" A policeman standing by the cabin waved a hand way over his head to the group gathered near Penny Jones. "Hey, over here!" Like a deer herd responding to a common stimulus, they all turned their heads, and their hides quivered as they tensed muscles into position, and their heads and necks left before their bodies and legs. And they ran toward the man by the cabin. Their boots and shoes pounded on the hard ground in the big quiet forest like hooves on a basketball court. Penny lowered the tip of his gun and let them go and touched the nearest tree to begin his escape. His eye caught the upside down face of a young woman he'd not noticed before. Alive. The young person twisted her head and her body, trying to right herself to say something to him. Penny, now aware the girl could see him, raised up and then bobbed back down, still watching through the branches and crap. "Please." Penny Jones thought that's what she said. The rope line jumped up and down, surging as the woman twisted, ramming her fist into the ground, growling with saliva and whatever caught in the throat. Her ankles lashed to the line. Her ankles lashed to the line.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'd like to invite you to check out our archive shows. We've just put them back online. They're at http://newdream.us. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.